the vessel. That was definitely alarming, said Marshall Goebbels. Blood clots can be fatal if they get carried to the lungs. So the person began taking blood-thinning medicine to break it down. Because of this surprising finding, the team asked a panel of experts to review all of the previous scans, and another small clot was spotted in one astronaut who had already returned to Earth. The team also had the participants test a device on the space station that encases their lower body in a chamber with lower air pressure for an hour to suck more blood into their legs. They found that this improved blood flow in 10 of 17 tests, but worsened in 2 of them. Marshall Goebbels says the findings may cause female astronauts to reconsider taking contraceptive pills to suppress their periods while on the space station, as this raises the risk of blood clots. Just as an example that nothing is completely good or completely bad, the moon's microgravity might have saved the life of the 8th man to walk on the moon, Apollo 15, James Irwin. Let me drop for a sec. On the moon, Irwin's heart rate rose to a dangerous level of 167 beats per minute after just 2 hours on the lunar surface, and he lost consciousness as a result of a brief heart rhythm disturbance called the bigeminy while transferring gear from the lunar to the command module. Were it not for the benefits of the moon's microgravity, it might have been a much bigger problem than it was at that time. When Irwin returned from the moon, he apparently found religion and even went on to search for the remains of Noah's Ark. NASA released a finding later on that Irwin was prone to heart arrhythmias, especially during heavy exercise. Irwin unfortunately suffered 3 major heart attacks while here on Earth. One occurred only 2 years after Apollo 15 mission. In 1974, at the age of 43, he was playing handball. A second heart attack happened in 1986 when he collapsed during a run. And his third and final fatal heart attack occurred in 1991 after a bike ride. He was the youngest astronaut who walked on the moon to die at the very young age of 61. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
N2GGS question.
Yes, N2GGS.
What's the life expectancy of someone born in 1942?
Offhand, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that if you Google it, you can find at least 100 pages that will tell you exactly. Actuarial tables are very popular. Insurance companies live and die from them. Google is your friend. I would suggest you simply Google that up, and I'm sure you'll find the exact numbers.
Thank you. And to GGS, clear.
Okay, on to the next. Let's see. Science, as I've mentioned in the past, is a process. 2 steps forward, 1 step back. We get closer and closer, but not by traveling in just one direction. Sometimes experimental findings suggest that something very important is happening that we don't have the faintest clue about. When the dust settles and the Nobel Prizes are given out, we have a better understanding of how things work. But sometimes the scientists fail to clean the test equipment properly or calibrate the measuring devices right, and that anomaly that might have led to one of those Nobel Prizes ends up in the city junk pile along with the polywater, the phlogiston, the luminescent ether, and those funny little neutrinos that were briefly thought to be traveling faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. Where this story will lead, only someone with a time machine or a lot of time on their hands will know for sure. Researchers in Hungary have published the exciting new claim that they've discovered a new subatomic particle, but it's nowhere near time to start talking about Nobel Prizes, as CNN has done. Let me drop for a sec. Since 2015, the team at the Institute of Nuclear Research and the University of Debrecen claims to have spotted a mysterious correlation between pairs of subatomic particles in their particle accelerator in Hungary. The observation stands in stark contrast with theoretical predictions and could be the signature of a previously unobserved force of nature. But like all controversial new results, this one will require further vetting and independent confirmation before it becomes gospel. Currently, scientists have four fundamental forces accounted for: gravity, electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for radioactive decay, and the strong nuclear force, which holds the atomic nuclei together. While these explain the matter that physicists have already observed, they believe that most of the universe's mass seems to be dark matter, stuff that clearly exerts gravity on the surrounding space but has no easy particle-based explanation. Perhaps there are other forces that communicate between regular matter and this dark matter, or just other particles that the scientists haven't spotted yet. Back in 2015, the team in Hungary published their first result in a physics preprint paper server. They struck lithium atoms with a proton beam, causing some of the lithium to suck up protons, turning into radioactive form of the element beryllium, and then have it decay. After enough data taking, they observed that at the angular separation between electrons and their antimatter counterparts called positrons emitted by the beryllium decay increased. The number of pairs of these particles decreased as expected, then spiked at 140 degrees. The discovery made headlines the following year when a team of physicists in the United States realized the anomaly might be explained by a new fourth particle, one that would also explain another ongoing anomaly observed in an experiment called muon G2 experiment that measures magnetic properties of a particle called a muon. The team in Hungary named the particle X17 since it weighed 17 mega electron volts. Let me drop for a sec. The new results on that same physics paper server seem to be another hint at this particle's existence with a new and improved setup. This time they struck a tritium target, basically a very heavy hydrogen atom, with a proton beam, and watched it suck up the proton and turn it into a heavier form of helium, then decay. Once again, they saw that spike in their electron-positron pairs, this time at a 115-degree separation. This is exciting stuff, but it's not Nobel-worthy quite yet, because that's not how particle physics works. Independent teams must now dive in and try to reproduce these results to ensure that there weren't any experimental sources of errors producing this signal. Physicists are taking the claim seriously, though. The NA64 experiment at CERN found no evidence of this decay last year, so their research continues. Other upcoming searches are underway or have been proposed. It would be a huge deal if scientists discovered a new fundamental force, but strong claims require strong evidence, including, most importantly, independent verification from other particle physicists and experiments from them. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I doubled earlier. I'm going back to the previous topic with the blood clots. You know, that tells me that they're taking a big chance on traveling to, not so much the moon, but to Mars, you know, where it's going to take them 6 to 8 months to maybe get there. So, you know, they're going to have to develop some kind of gravity system. So I did see a gravity system that could be used. You would launch three spacecraft, and you'd have, you know, two of them identical, open up and have this truss set up, open up, and, you know, to maybe 150 feet, and you attach the two identical spacecraft, one on one end and one on the other, and then use, you know, little thrusters to start spinning them. You know, so you don't have a wheel, but you have this big contraption spinning, rotating until you get to Mars, and then you could reverse the thrust and bring everything back close, back down, and then you'd separate the crew vehicle, you know, that was on one end, and then, you know, you could go down and land on Mars. I know it's an expensive system, but you know, you can guarantee that gravity won't be a problem. Back to you, Roy.
I would agree with you. I mean, it's not going to solve the radiation problem, but there's a lot of problems with weightlessness. The human beings are really not particularly designed for any of this. So unless, they come up with a lot of little physiological tricks to kind of trick the body into sort of thinking that it's kind of on the Earth, they're going to have to supply their own gravitational version of gravity. Otherwise, I don't know how they're going to handle it. The weakness alone, I mean, I'm sure you've read articles of people who are in microgravity once they come back to Earth. They are not ready to run any races. I don't care how much exercise they do on the ISS. And we're expecting people to just kind of land on Mars and to get working the next day. I don't know how that happens.
That's going to be a big problem. A lot of gravity is one-third of Earth, so it's not as big as the problem when they land here. You know, you see them land here, and they'll land in Kazakhstan, and they carry them out, and they put them on these lawn chairs. They look like, you know, beach chairs, and they carry them off. You know, it's much more severe here on Earth, but it's still pretty bad on Mars. So they're going to have to do something with that. You know, Mark Kelly was the one guy that he was up there for a year. His counterpart from Russia as well. I wouldn't be surprised if he was one of the astronauts that they detected a problem. Right now you have Christina Cook up there now. She's going to be up there for a year. And I'm sure they're going to be anxious to find out what her system is like when they get back. But either way, you know, she's not going to be standing up, you know, starting to build a habitat right after they land. You're right. Back to you, Roy.
I mean, I'm as curious as the next guy, and I love technology, and my childhood is imprinted with the Apollo program. It was a very important part of the history that I lived through. So I could understand the romance and the glamour of wanting to land human beings on Mars. I just don't for the life of me know how they presume to do it without killing them all. I don't know. It seems to be an engineering nightmare. And I really understand that NASA tends to have kind of gung-ho, we'll figure out a way somehow type of thing. Because, you know, when Kennedy proposed landing on the moon, there were a lot of people who thought that it would never happen or we would destroy ourselves. I still can recall people in the 70s and 80s who used to tell each other that the weather used to be much, much better before they started to shoot rockets into the sky.
I remember that. Okay, very good. But they've got to do something with the gravity because you said blood-thinning pills. What are you going to do, send baby aspirins? Everybody's going to take baby aspirins. I'm sure they have stronger medication, but still, it was a major amount of people. I think out of nine, you said five or something had a problem. Well, whatever it was a big number. You know, you can't take that kind of chance on the way to Mars. You know, never mind not being able to construct a shelter after you land. You know, you have to have these people living and breathing by the time they get there. They can't have blood clots. Back to you, Roy.
I agree with you entirely, Paul, and Dick agrees with us. This seems to be a common topic for us to fall into, that although we would love to have things like a manned Mars flight, we don't have the faintest clue of how the heck it can be accomplished without an incredible risk of life. And, you know, the NASA program was a risky program. They downplayed it a great deal, but those guys were brave people, intensely. And a few of them, unfortunately, didn't make it through the program. So I hope the engineers are smarter than we are, because they're the ones who have to come up with the solution to these solutionless problems.
Yeah, well, they've always suspected problems like that. I know they have that gadget on the ISS to push the blood back to their feet. The Russians have it. So we had it up there as well, but you said that did not work either. I mean, it helped, but it didn't work 100%. You know, you have to have this thing work 100%. The engineers, yeah, well, I'm sure they're going to be good at what they're doing, but they have to be directed by the doctors, you know. Once they have the go-ahead from them, then I guess that would be okay. All right, I'll let you continue on. This is WS2M.
Yeah, very good, Paul. I guess the ultimate solution is to have those weird genetic engineers in China cook up a brew of human beings that are built for zero gravity.
You're going to change the DNA? I've seen all those articles. We got a long way for that. You know, that's a... If possible, you know, you want to change the way humans are, you know, this way they can travel through space without being affected by things like radiation. Although that gravity problem, you're not going to overcome that. I think you need a spinning something. Back to you, Roy.
Different people will try different things. I mean, ultimately, if you change the thing that's riding in there, you know, we've talked before, robots are a perfect solution, but there's no glamour to having robots land on planets, unfortunately. So you could probably fiddle with genes enough to come up with something that tolerates zero gravity much better than we do. I don't know if they would qualify as human beings anymore, but, you know, the Chinese are, right now, they're putting their energies into cloning people's pet poodles and such. So who knows how much of a jump it is from that to the ultimate zero gravity Chinese astronaut.
Okay, very good. I'll let you continue on. I don't know. I know I got my name signed up for the next rover when it lands on Mars. I hope it makes it. I think that's about as close as I'm going to get. Back to you. Back to Ned.
At the start of this decade, the federal government called out consumer DNA testing as a burgeoning scam industry. Little did they know how it would explode in popularity. In 2010, the United States Government Accountability Office published an investigative report that bashed consumer DNA test companies for misleading the public. It accused them of deceptively claiming their products could predict the odds of developing more than a dozen medical conditions. Some even went as far as to offer equally dubious dietary supplements. The report had followed a similar lambasting of the industry by the same agency in 2006. Also in 2010, the FDA publicly warned 23andMe and other companies that genetic health tests were considered medical devices and needed to be cleared by the Food and Drug Administration before they could be sold to the public. 3 years later, following a lack of response from 23andMe, the agency took the harsh step of temporarily banning 23andMe from selling its health-related tests at all. Despite these hurdles, the DNA testing industry has nevertheless exploded. According to a report by MIT Technology Review this February, more than 26 million people have had their DNA tested by the biggest names in the industry, with Ancestry DNA, 23andMe, and MyHeritage being the top three. Consumer DNA testing is undoubtedly mainstream now. It's not much less scammy than it was when the decade began. The industry has existed since the late 1990s, but in 2007, the new kid on the block, 23andMe, became the first company to offer a particular kind of at-home DNA test that was cheap, easy to use, and promised to track back your origins further back than ever before. Let me drop for a second. 23andMe tests, and eventually those of its competitors, search for and analyze the most common genetic variations called single nucleotide polymorphisms. In our autosomal DNA, the 22 of 23 pairs of chromosomes are not used to determine sex. But for as little as $99 and a spit sample, these single nucleotide polymorphism-based tests are advertised to determine a person's ancestry or genetic health risk. But much of this realm of consumer DNA testing, as the GAO report shows, can uncharitably be described as complete BS. The crux of the problem is that our genetics are only a piece of the puzzle that influences our health. Sure, you can sometimes point to a specific gene mutation. It always makes someone sick in a specific way if they carry it. But much more often, it's a complex, barely understood mix of gene variants that predispose us to develop cancers or heart disease. And that risk can be amplified or muted by our environment, including the crucial months we spend in the womb. In the earliest days, companies didn't much care for this complexity, using weak evidence to make sweeping health claims about which genes ought to make you more of a fish eater or develop diabetes. Following the FDA's ban in 2013, 23andMe spent the next 2 years devising genetic health tests that wouldn't overpromise. In 2015, it was allowed to sell these tests that people took for if they carried recessive mutations for genetic conditions like Bloom syndrome and sickle cell disease. A positive test meant their children have a 25% chance of having the condition if both parents were carriers. 2 years later, they became the first company with FDA-approved tests that were allowed to tell people about their risk of developing one of the 10 diseases or conditions, such as late-onset Alzheimer's or celiac disease. I drop for a second. 23andMe's return to the health side of things wasn't the only fuse that lit a fire under the consumer DNA industry. The tens of millions in annual advertising now spent by companies like My Ancestry certainly helped as well. But regardless, the FDA approval of these tests signaled a new opening in the industry, and unsurprisingly, the industry as a whole has ballooned and has a glut of scammy services on offer. Many of these companies now steer clear of making blanket health claims, but it doesn't make them any less laughable. Your DNA results can apparently tell you whether you found your romantic match, how to be good at soccer, and like a decade ago, how to find the perfect diet and avoid bloating. Just don't pay attention to the study showing that there's no consistent link between genes seemingly tied to our nutrition and our actual diet-related conditions. It's not only the tests vaguely connected to our health that are the problem. Even relying on these DNA tests to figure out your ancestry is a dicey proposition. At best, you're roughly estimating where your recent ancestors lived, but that estimate can vary widely depending on which company does the testing, thanks to the different algorithms they use. And the farther away your lineage is from Europe, the less accurate these tests will be for you, thanks to the fact that these algorithms, as well as the research linking genes to our health, are largely based on DNA of white Americans and Europeans. Health and ancestry aside, sharing your DNA with the outside world can have unintended consequences. Law enforcement agencies are now using genealogy databases to solve criminal cases by connecting anonymous crime scene DNA to DNA submitted to those family tree companies, working backwards through distant relatives to identify their suspect. And while some people may be fine with this genetic sleuthing, there are no clear rules on how this data can be used by law enforcement. There's merely the promise by the private companies that they will share responsibly. This November, police in Florida obtained a warrant to search through a third-party genealogy database, months after the service had enforced a new opt-in policy meant to let users decide if they wanted their data to be searchable by police in these cases. At a certain point, it won't even matter whether you've decided to share your DNA. A study last October estimates that once enough people's DNA is in the database, a scant 2 to 3% of any given population, anyone could conceivably track the identity of every person in that population using the same techniques genetic detectives are using now. And researchers have already demonstrated how less scrupulous forces, such as hackers, could actively manipulate these databases. Let me drop for a second. none of this is meant to diminish the real potential of genetics as a field of research and medicine, nor the progress that has been made over the past decade. Companies like 23andMe rely on detecting thousands of genetic markers, still only a tiny slice of our DNA. But the technology that allows the person's entire genome to be sequenced has vastly improved, scaling down its cost and upkeep over the past decade. These techniques can scan a person's entire genome as well as the smaller part of the genome that codes for the proteins on our body's cells make, called exomes. In 2010, for instance, company Illumina initially offered a whole genome sequencing at $50,000 a person. This year, Veritas dropped the price of its service to only $600 and says that it will soon charge as little as $100. These innovations have led to large-scale research projects that collect genetic data from hundreds of thousands of people at once. Scientists can scour through these large data sets to find new links between our genes, traits, and medical conditions. This research has helped us better understand long-standing questions about our biology and health. Someday soon, genetic sequencing may also help us optimize the existing medical treatments people get, particularly for conditions like cancer. Let me drop for a second. Right now, though, it's still up in the air about how useful this info dump really is to the average person looking to stay healthy. In March, 23andMe debuted, or more accurately, reintroduced a service that tells people about their genetic risks of type 2 diabetes. Unlike the tests approved by the Food and Drug Administration, it relies on what's known as a polygenic risk score. This adds up the very small contributions of many genetic markers to a particular condition, which combined might be enough to nudge your overall risk upwards. The trouble is that these markers have little to do with why you get type 2 diabetes. Your age, your weight play a much bigger role, and even if the test does consider you genetically unlucky, the advice you'll get is the same as anyone hoping for a long, healthy life would get. Eat more vegetables, exercise more, you know. This test, as well as many of those offered by hundreds of big and small DNA testing companies on the market, illustrates the uncertainty of personalized consumer genetics. The bet that companies like 23andMe are making is that they can untangle this mess and translate their results back to people in a way that won't cross the line into deceptive marketing while still convincing their customers they truly matter. Other companies have teamed up with outside labs and doctors to look over customers' genes and have hired genetic counselors to go over their results, which might place them on a safer legal medical go-around. But it still raises the question of whether people will benefit from this information that they get. And because our knowledge of the relationship between genes and health is constantly changing, it's very possible that DNA testing you take in 2020 will tell you a totally different story than one in 2030. Given how popular at-home DNA testing has become, there's really no sealing that genie back in the bottle. So if you want to get your genetic horoscope read this holiday, don't let this particular story necessarily stop you, but it's a big decision that you should sleep on. After all, your DNA is out there, and it's no going back after you have it tested. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Oh, ZDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I think one of the areas that's probably most disconcerting is if the health insurance industry gets the data and then, of course, starts affecting people's premiums, what they have to pay for insurance. Of course, the extreme case is the example in the movie Gattaca that's been running lately.
Yeah, that was a pretty good movie. Well, what's interesting is Gattaca is you know, is the abbreviation for the four nitrogenous bases of DNA. So the writer was being cute about that. But yeah, that's another factor. It can raise your price if they decide that you're in a higher risk category, you know, like people are with cars and such. That could be a problem as well. Technology always does that. Technology gives you with one hand and they take things away with the other. So you have to kind of figure things out and put proper laws into action to kind of mediate the negative repercussions of any technology. Okay, on to the next. In September, the Indian Space Research Organization lost contact with its Vikram lander as it was making its descent to the lunar surface. If you were one of the people who guessed that Vikram crashed, well, you were correct. In a report to lawmakers, the ISRO has confirmed that Vikram did indeed hard land. According to the report, Vikram's braking thrusters malfunctioned, though they don't know why, and it crashed within about a third of a mile from its designated landing site. All is not lost, though. All of the 8 scientific instruments apparently are still functioning and, quote, providing valuable scientific data, end quote, said Jitendra Singh, Minister of State for the Department of Space. Had ISRO successfully landed Vikram on the moon, it would have made India only the 4th country in history to make a moon landing. ISRO might be able to salvage the mission, but the mishap is disheartening and a reminder that landing on the moon is still hard. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I think they're going to try again. They haven't confirmed that they'll support it, but, you know, they're going full blast over there. I mean, they even have a manned space program. They plan on launching a couple of astronauts into orbit by the end of 2022. So, you know, I mean, they're gung-ho. So, now, it turns out the NASA Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter has taken a picture, and they knew what the land looked like before and after of the Chinese one that crashed a while back, you know, I forget the year. So, you know, they could spot these things with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So I think that might eventually turn up in pictures if it's only a couple, like you said, 500 meters away or something. I wouldn't be surprised if NASA comes up with that. That thing has taken some terrific pictures, and it's found, you know, different things that have crashed or even landed, and taken pictures. It's taken pictures of all the Apollo landing sites. So I think we're going to find out eventually how close they made it. You know, they would have been the 4th, you said. Yeah, and they would have been the 5th if Israel had made it a few months earlier, but they crashed too. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, although we were able to accomplish it so many years ago, it was a very difficult task. And it's not like it's gotten that much easier. I mean, the equipment has gotten smaller and more functional and more flexible, but there are still some engineering problems that are difficult to surmount. So I wish them luck on this. I hope they don't lose any astronauts along the way. But, you know, I don't feel any threat if other countries land manned people on the moon. You know, we did it first, so we get that credit for it. You know, whoever comes second is going to have their own fame as the guys who came second.
It's inevitable anyway. You know, you're going to have different countries. You're going to have private companies. There's, there's no way of unwinding that spring.
And all things considered, I'd rather have countries expend time, effort, and money showing off how smart they are by landing on the moon and other places rather than building more destructive weapons.
Yeah, you know, especially India. You know, they're pretty good, but we still don't go along with them. They're not part of the International Space Station. And that's because they're still officially at war with Pakistan, and we can't be involved with somebody that's in that situation. Some kind of ruling that pre- prevents us from doing that. So, but you know, they're doing good. And, yeah, sooner or later they're going to make it. They're all going to make it eventually, sooner or later. And then collectively, I think it'll be the next time for us, we're going to be involved with the European Space Agency, similar to the ISS. But I'd still like to find out how close India came to landing. They said they cheaped out on their thrusters. They were using these pulse type thrusters instead of a variable. I think it was $175 million, which was inexpensive compared to what we would have done. Back to you, Roy. AC2GSWS20.
Okay, very good information. I think the problem is, diplomatically, we have equal relations with Pakistan. So we can't get too cozy with India, or Pakistan will get jealous. It's a mess. Well, is there any particular reasoning for why China is the odd man out doing its own thing?
Well, they're, you know, a dictatorship. We don't have that kind of trade agreement with them, so we're not signed up with them. But it's weird because other countries that are, let's say, signed up with the European Space Agency, like France and others, have, they do make deals with China, and they'll make, you know, cooperative missions, but we don't. It's really strange, until the world changes, it's going to be like that.
Okay, I was just wondering. I mean, God knows Russia isn't the most democratic democracy in the world either.
I know, true. But, we've been, you know, ever since the Soyuz Apollo mission, they wanted to keep that going. There's been a lot of people that wanted, you know, in politics and in NASA, that wanted NASA to get involved with China, but they always stopped that. But, you know, Russia started back in 1974. That was the Apollo Soyuz, where they docked together, and you know, we've been going at it ever since, and it's worked out. You know, I mean, we've actually built the entire space station with Russia and 20 other countries.
Hey, thanks a lot, Paul. Yeah, my attitude is the more the merrier. If anyone wants to join, as long as they got the proper spirit for it, whether it's your democracy or a make-believe democracy, science, thankfully, is just science. Let me do my last story for tonight that is a very, very oddball spin on NASA. What do ex-NASA engineers go on to do after they've left NASA, you might ask yourself? Well, Mark Rober, a former NASA Jet Propulsion Lab engineer, recently teamed up with a James Bruton, a ex-toy designer and all-around expert hacker, to become two of the world's most talented bowlers. But instead of spending years practicing and honing their skills, they turned to science and engineering to cleverly hack a bowling ball to go wherever they steered it. Yup, a modern technology analogy of shaved dice. After slicing a ball in half, Rober discovered that inside it was asymmetrically weighted, which is what allows professional bowlers to magically curve their throws down the lane by putting spin on the ball. Rober and Bruton took this idea one step further and upgraded their bowling ball with an asymmetrical weight inside that could be remotely shifted from side to side. The bowling ball's guts were replaced with an electronic and mechanical mechanism that's similar to what you'd find inside the many self-balancing Star Wars BB-8 toys, but with one important additional feature. It had a pivoting pendulum weight. The weight shifted from side to side in response to the bowler's movement, which are detected by a wearable motion sensor, and that in turn causes the ball to dramatically change directions even multiple times as it rolls down a bowling lane. Is it cheating? Yes, of course it is. there zero chance this ball would be approved for professional or league play, and presumably with its innards replaced, it weighs much less than a regulation ball does anyway. But it's not like Rober and Bruton immediately entered competitions once their hack ball was perfected and tried to scam their way to prize money. It's a hack for hack's sake to see if it was even possible. It just took a couple of engineering wizards to make it possible. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2 Jet.
It sounds like it would be very good for the movie industry, Roy, WS2N. You know, they wouldn't have to take a second take, you know. Hey, you need to get a strike on this one. Okay.
Indeed. I mean, if we were still in the age of film, it would save them a lot of film. Now it's just everything's getting recorded to hard drives, so they just kind of keep on doing it, but it would save them time. So who knows? You never know. I mean, it would be, I guess really it depends upon how quirky it is, how easy it is to maintain. I'm sure a lot of guys, if the price point was low enough, would buy it as a kind of, a toy to kind of, April Fool's people with.
Very good. Okay, very good. I never heard that one. I know a lot of the guys go on to, you know, bigger and better things. They, you know, they open up their own companies and everything, but trick bowling ball, that's a new one on me.
It probably beats the Segway. I mean, these are all very, very clever, very smart people, and they go all different ways. Again, I would rather he use his talent to build these type of self-propelled bowling balls than weapons of destruction. So, yeah. I thought it was a cute little story of what NASA engineers get to after the fact. Anyway, it's coming up to 11, so it's going to soon be time for a space report. So I just want to once again remind everyone, all these articles and the Veritasium video of the puzzles and visual demonstrations of the results are going to be available on my page. All you have to do is type on your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. And all the links will be available to you. And if you have any questions, any comments, any topics you'd like me to cover, want to give me some ideas for puzzlers, or if you want to get in touch with Paul and the Space Report, or if you want to get in touch with Dick and the mailbag, tech questions, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. So, once again, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight, and I hope you were amused by some of the stories and the puzzles and such, and maybe learned a few things. So, as always, thanks to Paul, and certainly thanks to Dick for the opportunity to do this on a weekly basis, and I'll be back next Sunday night, and hopefully I'll figure out another puzzle. I'm sure I'll find out lots of new stories. So, thanks, everyone, and I will turn it over to Dick so he can turn it over to Paul.
You've got it, Paul. Thank you, Roy. Go ahead, Paul.
Very good. Yeah, very well done. Yeah, I think like some astronauts have gone into their own business. One guy, he opened up a rocket company. He's building a super-duper ion rocket, much more powerful than what they have today. It's called a Bessemer engine, and his name is Chang Diaz. Comes out of, he did like 6 or 7 shuttle flights, I don't know how many spacewalks. But then when he retired years ago, he was always a physicist, and he's got his own company. He's born in Costa Rica. He's got part of his company down there and the other part in Houston, Texas. And eventually he plans on getting his approval from NASA to put his rocket on the space station. But you got guys like that. But I like the bowling ball stuff. This is WS2M for the SpaceNet report. Let me drop it. Fan on so I don't cook this radio. You know, lately I've been forgetting to announce these International Space Station passes that we can see from, in my case, Long Island. I'm out in Suffolk County, but it's good enough. There was one just two nights ago. I'm trying to think which night that was. Just two nights ago they had, let me look it up here. Yeah, it was 5 o'clock at night, 5:03, and it was a 1.7 magnitude at 16 degrees, and it was perfect. You could see it solidly for 4 minutes going overhead from the northwest to the northeast, and now there's a couple more passes now. We have bad weather tonight. Tomorrow, two more passes, but we could cross that off the list. But then there's another one that will be on Wednesday, will be pretty good. That's going to be, again, 14 degrees above the horizon. So as long as you don't have too many trees nearby, you should be able to see this thing. And that'll be a minus 1.4 magnitude. Again, going from the northwest to the northeast. So that should be pretty good. The one I saw was minus 1.9, so it was a little bit brighter than those two, but still pretty good. You know, anything in that area. There's no clouds. It's amazing to watch that go by. And each time, it always takes about 4 or 5 minutes to pass. And the following week, I'll make an announcement for the following week. There's another one that's going to be like going right overhead, like 78 degrees off the horizon. That's always exciting, you know, just to look up and see this light going by in the sky and realize that there's six people on board right now. Sitting there with two manned space stations, manned spacecraft attached that could fly back to Earth at any time, and also a couple of cargo vehicles attached as well. There's I think a total of 8 ports on the space station. And right now, I think 6 of them are filled. There's 8 docking ports, 4 for the Russian side and 4 for the American European Space Agency side. So that's the story on that. I wanted to talk about the EVA that's coming up. There's 3 events coming up next week, right away, starting Monday, and another one Wednesday, and another one Friday. You have an EVA, which is going to happen tomorrow morning, and that'll be with Drew Morgan and Luca Pomitano. Luca is from Italy. You might remember him from years ago in 2013 when his helmet started to fill up with water and they had to cut that EVA short, after only about an hour outside. Well, since then he's been back to Earth and now he's back on a space station doing it again. But this time with no water in the helmet problems, they solved that problem. But they're going to be out working again on the AMS, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. So that'll be Monday, and then two days later on December 4th, you have a launch from Launch Complex 40 out of Florida up to the International Space Station. CRS-19, that will be another Dragon flight by SpaceX, and that'll follow 2 days later by another cargo vehicle being launched from Russia, Progress, another Progress vehicle. So, now, onto this EVA. It's going to take about 4 EVAs to repair the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. I call it a telescope. Physicists don't like to call it that because it doesn't really focus or bring light rays into the unit But what happens, it takes all the passive elements, electrons, positrons, protons, you know, and you know, you take an electron and you take the antiparticle, the positron. It could detect these things. It has millions of them since it's been attached. Went up in 2010, and they attached it to the International Space Station on the Zenith location, the top of the space station on one of the truss segments going out, the starboard three. It's been attached there. It weighs over 7,000 pounds. No, correction, over 14,000 pounds, 7 tons. And the idea is to look for all these, you know, cosmic rays or all these ions flying through space. And, it, you know, they thought this thing was going to work for, like, they were hoping for, like, 3 or 4 years. It went, like, 7 years. But eventually started to fail. And I've talked about this before on the net, but bear with me. They've got four of these cooling pumps, these pumps that pump liquid carbon dioxide, CO2, back and forth throughout this unit to keep it cool. And those pumps, they need, well, you know, at least one to be working. And that's what they got down to. Three have completely failed. So this started happening, you know, a couple of years ago. And it took all these years now to develop a system. They had to invent 25 different tools to send up to the space station. They had to train these two astronauts. That's why they're the only two going out and doing this. They spent years training to repair this thing. It was never designed to be repaired. This WS-20. Wasn't like the Hubble. Hubble was definitely designed to be repaired. This thing was, they thought it was going to be a sealed system, and let's not worry about it. Well, on the first spacewalk a couple of weeks ago, Drew and Luca went out, and they needed to prep this thing. So they got all these tools and brought them out to the work area. They attached Luca on the end of the robotic arm. They just put his feet attached to it, and the arm is, you know, it's got like a 57-foot arm, reaches out all the way to the location where he's going to work, and then Drew Morgan helps him out, and he assists anything he needs. First EVA, they needed to do a couple of things just to prep. They needed to disconnect this panel that behind the panel is going to be where all these lines are that they have to cut. They actually have to cut all these stainless steel lines and then repipe them to the new pumps. So, you know, on the first mission, they actually got this massive panel out. It was too big to bring through the airlock, so they just threw it away into space. And that's gone forever. Now they needed to cut all these different blankets, these insulating and micromedia blankets. They had to cut them away from the work area, and they invented special tools for every little thing that you cut. You can't just let it go into space. It has to be captured. And eventually they cut dozens of these things, and eventually was able to pull blankets off and get access to where they're going to be able to work. They needed to install handrails and footrails surrounding this thing. It was never designed to be worked on, so they didn't have any handrails. It was all completed a couple of weeks ago. EVA was over in like 6 or 7 hours. Now tomorrow they're going to go out and second EVA they went out. That was the first EVA. The second EVA they went out and they started to finally cut these lines and get ready to pipe them into the new pumps. And they got to put a new bracket on the outside of the alpha magnetic spectrometer. This new bracket will eventually hold the new pumps. They're just going to leave the old pumps where they are, and they're just going to repipe everything out to the new pumps. And in this box with all these new pumps, there's going to be a new accumulator, a new filters, new everything, new valves. You know, it's a whole setup. But they need to get these eight lines piped to it. The problem is that all eight lines, again, they were never designed to be serviced. You don't know what they look like. I mean, they don't, they're all not matched. They're not different colors. They're all stainless steel. And they're all 0.157, 157 thousandths of, you know, millimeter. And you convert that, and it comes out to around 1/6 of an inch in diameter. Just 1/6 of an inch. So, you know, I mean, we have common sizes, you know, that you can get in Home Depot at a 1/8 or 1/4. And this is somewhere in between, around 1/6 of a, you know, an inch. Very, very small. And they need to cut all of these eight lines, and they did that. And they, before they did that, they needed to cut a little thicker line to bleed off the carbon dioxide that was inside this unit that they had to bleed it off the space. At least they didn't need a vacuum pump to make sure it was completely evacuated, because they're in space, completely bled off. And then they actually cut the lines. This EVA, they're going to be bringing the pumps out. They're going to be setting the pumps up. They're going to be trying to tie these lines in. They have swedging tools, special tools that they invented to connect all of these eight lines to the pumps. So it should be interesting. That's tomorrow's EVA. So I'm looking forward to that. I think it starts early, like 5:30 in the morning. But it'll be going all day long. It'll probably be going like 6 hours. Usually about 6-7 hours for an EVA nowadays. But the alpha magnetic spectrometer, the way it works is it's pretty amazing. They have all these detectors. There's a series of eight different types of detectors attached to this. Well, does anybody have any questions or comments? This is WS2M. Well, okay. They have these detectors that are situated in different locations in this unit. And one is called the time of flight detector. So they have two of them, one at the top and one at the bottom. So as a subatomic particle comes through, it'll hit the TOF. They shorten it to TOF, but time of flight detector. And that will turn all the other detectors on. And then there's one at the bottom that detects the particle when it leaves, and that shuts everything off. But this happens, you know, in microseconds, or, you know, or actually nanoseconds. Because, you know, these things are traveling almost the speed of light. So it's a time of flight detector that sets everything in motion. So as a particle comes through, this magnetic field, I described it a couple of weeks ago, is 6,000 neodymium boron magnets. They're all about 2 inches square. They're like 2 by 2 by, you know, half inch magnets. 6,000 of them that are epoxied together. And into this big cylinder type of structure. And as the these particles come through, they just come from anywhere. They hit this magnetic field, and they start to bend and curve. And one type of element will, like an electron, will start to curve one way. A positron will go another way. A proton will go another way. And they could tell from this, all these different types of detectors, again, the time of flight detector kicks everything on, a particle comes flying through. Other detectors within the unit can tell which way the particle is going, so they now know whether or not it's an electron or a positron. They know how fast it's going. They have different detectors for that. And they basically do the math. They have these supercomputers attached to attached to this unit. They say it's about 100 times more powerful than any, you know, more processing power than anything else attached to the space station at the time. And they could, you know, they do the math and they figure out the mass of these particles that they're going through. So they figure out everything about it with all these eight detectors. And one, there's one set of detectors that surround the unit because these particles come from all directions. They would like to know which